This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On ABC Listen.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
Keeping the conversation going.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Hello, it's the last week of free public transport. After that, it's half price to the end of the year. So if you've changed your habits, do you think that's going to stick? Or if you haven't, why? And why didn't you take advantage of it? Was it not about the price? Was it not about the fuel? Will you go back to a car or walking or cycling? I'd love to hear from you what your experience has been of free public transport. Should it stay free? And will your habits stick? Will you remember to put that Mikey to tap it on? Very soon, we're going to be getting the first look at hard data showing how much our public transport habits either changed or did not changed over these months with free public transport. But let me know your story. Maybe you didn't hop on more public transport. Why is that? We know, of course, there's a big divide between the urban areas and the regions. What does it mean to you? Will you keep these habits up if it's half price to the end of the year? I'd love to hear from you. Also, let's continue the conversation you heard Raf talk about on mornings. The latest Redbridge poll says that One Nation would win as many as 59 seats if an election were held today. So, do independents need to band together? Would you be more or less likely to vote for an independent if they were to form a party, as has been floated, we can see in this morning's news coverage? What does it mean to you to have independents in a party? Are they more electable if they are in one? Would they sway your vote that way? Or are they less electable? We've heard this morning that the Victorian federal MPs who are independent, Monique Ryan and Helen Haynes, have ruled themselves out of this. Do you think that's a good idea? Also this hour, how much do you spend on your pet? Are you going to confess it to me? Maybe what's your biggest expense? Is it dishing out for gourmet meals? Is it luxury hotels when you're on holidays? Is it birthday presents? Let me know, because the latest figures are that Australians are now spending more than $21 billion a year on their pets. Of course, on medications and vet bills, we know that, but spending on pet food alone rose 51% since 2022 to almost $10 billion annually. Tell me right now, are you cooking up some gourmet grub for Goofy? Some foodie delight for Fifi? Or do you say no, only the kibble? These are tough times, Pooch. We're going to be looking at why it's important to actually keep on top of how much we are devoted to our pets. Also this hour, why is Victoria's largest sexual health and education centre closing its CBD facility, even as sexually transmitted infections remain at near record levels? What's going on there? We will look into that. Lorraine, you've called in from Richmond. You wanted to join the conversation about public transport. Have you been using it more?
Yeah, well, I always use it anyway. I always use it in conjunction. I always use it in conjunction with my bike. I also wanted to say that I'm cooking up a gourmet storm now with toast and Vegemite. But
toast and Vegemite for your pet?
No, for me.
Oh, okay, good.
But it's just so easy, and if they could make it easier for cyclists to get on the train, the new trains now don't have. An echo in here, it's terrible. The new trains now don't have anywhere for you to be able to sit and have your bike. Some of them do, but then that hassle of getting the card out of your wallet, and you've got to put it back in your coat again for fear of it you losing it down the train tracks.
You've enjoyed not having to reach for the Mikey.
Yeah, so much easier just not having to pay at all. Or if we could have a system where it's like skiing and you just go through and it clicks you without having to get out of your bag.
Well, we're going to get a new system eventually, we're told, but are you afraid that you're going to forget to tap on next week, Lorraine?
Oh, no, I don't think I'll forget.
Those habits really do, yes, stick sometimes. It hasn't been that long that we've had free public transport. Thank you, Lorraine. So what do you think? If you've changed your habits, if you're using public transport more, will that stick with you? Is half price good enough? Or if not, will you go back to a car or walking or cycling? Someone who's been looking at this very question is Malad Haghani, who's Associate Professor and Principal Fellow in Urban Risk and Resilience at the University of Melbourne. Thanks for joining me, Malad.
Oh, good day, Mary. Good to be with you.
You've been looking right from the beginning of this social experiment, shall we say, at three states, Victoria, New South Wales, Queensland. We were the only ones to have free public transport. Is that right? So you were able to compare commuter patterns against each other?
Yeah, that's right. And from an academic standpoint, we were very happy that we were the only ones because that gave us a benchmark of comparison. Free public transport is probably one of the most contentious areas of transport policy. You might think that it's very simple. It's economic 101, that you reduce the price of something, goods or services, or you make them free, and consumer is going to use it more. And that is to some extent true about consumption of public transport as well. People are rational decision makers. But when it comes to public transport in particular, the situation is more complex. It matters when the demand comes from. Is it coming more from public transport users taking more trips? Is it coming from active transport users? Or is it causing a shift from car dependency to public transport? So when the policy was announced, it gave us a perfect opportunity of studying this debate empirically in conjunction with other states that did not change their public transport pricing regime. A comparison of these Victoria and New South Wales in particular came very handy. During a time where the price of fuel was volatile, we could see how much people are shifting from cars across the two states to public transport. And through this comparison, we got a fair idea of how public transport changes people's travel behavior.
So what did you find? We've got Victoria with free public transport. It was, 50%, I think, price in New South Wales. Was there much of a difference in the uptake between the two states?
Look, we surveyed over 4,000 people during this period of time over the 2 months, periodically at different points in time. What we realized was that Queensland was an anomaly in our studies, especially because of the fact that they haven't established nearly free public transport, and we assume that their public transport demand has already been saturated. There is not much sensitivity as much as there is in Victoria and New South Wales. But across every wave of survey that we did, we observed by and large similar degree of shift away from cars to public transport. Between 25 to 30% of people, depending on when we did the survey, reported that they have shifted some trips over the last 2 months away from car to public transport. But strikingly, these numbers at any point in time that we looked at it was very much similar, only marginally different between New South Wales and Victoria. And the conclusion for us was that, yes, people are sensitive to price and they are reacting to the price of fuel, but the free public transport per se is not being the driver of this shift. Otherwise, we would have seen a different level of shift in Victoria compared to New South Wales.
That is fascinating. You're hearing from Malad Haghani, who's been looking into this. And Malad, I want to dig a bit deeper into your conclusion there. But Liz is calling from Warrigal. You're catching a train as we speak, Liz.
No, not catching a train right now. But my long-term partner lives in Geelong. I live in Warrigal. And I've been driving over there in a diesel engine for the last 10 years or more. And when this crisis hit with the prices, I just panicked a little bit and thought, oh, how the hell am I going to pay for all this? So I've switched to public transport on a Friday night and it's been going really, really well.
So it was fuel definitely for you, Liz. That was the driver.
The fuel and the fuel prices. I do love the freedom of my car and being able to go. I do a lot of kilometres generally. But I had to cut. I couldn't afford it. I couldn't afford to do it.
So, Liz, when the price goes up next week, half price, and even next year, full price, do you think that you'll continue the habit of that Friday night trip by public transport?
I will definitely continue to factor in a train trip. I may not always do it, but I will definitely factor in a train trip because it's just a little bit more less stress, and it was also definitely much gentler on my budget, I can say that.
That's so interesting. And so for you, Liz, as well, it's improved your view of public transport, is that right?
Yes, to a degree. Yes, to a degree. Look, the train system in Melbourne is a little bit befuddling. I don't quite understand how you, each week, that train, I catch the same train there and from, but every single week I've done it now for the last six times I've done it, it's taken me to a different platform and I've had to catch another train from a different platform. It's totally befuddling. So every time I get into the station, I've got to decide, okay, how am I going to find out where I've got to catch the train from?
Liz, you are not alone in that befuddlement. Thank you so much for leaning in, because Malad Hagani, I'm sure, was listening with a lot of interest there. Associate Professor and Principal Fellow at the University of Melbourne. We're talking about the data of how much people have changed their habits and whether it's going to stick. And Liz's experience, Malad, is really typical, isn't it?
It is absolutely typical. In fact, if I may speak to some upsides of this trial of free public transport in Victoria, there are upsides to it. First of all, it made a difference in terms of cost of living to pre-existing public transport users and whoever shifted to public transport. Personally, myself, I probably have saved $300 over this period of time being a public transport user. So that's undeniable. From an academic perspective, it created a perfect landscape for us for the first time we study this and present some findings that would probably be of the international significance. That's another story. But also when we ask people who experience public transport more often or for the first time during this period as a result of it becoming free or shifting away because of fuel price being too high, they express that it has, predominantly they have said that this has improved their view of public transport. So Liz's experience has been very typical. And a majority of them, over 50%, has said either they will continue to use public transport as a main mode of commute, or they will consider it more often into their future. So that exposure of people, otherwise car users, to public transport, it has made a difference.
Rhonda, you've called in. You're in Raglan. I'm not sure how I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Yes, that's right.
Have you been taking advantage of the free public transport?
Yes, as has my daughter, but what I do worry about is that there hasn't been the infrastructure to cater for all the people getting on, and what has been upsetting is that there have been some really fights over seats.
Fights over seats?
Yes, really. And
on what? Was it a tram or a train, Rhonda?
No, a train. The Ballarat line.
Of course, because there were...
And not just once, like every day. And I think, oh, who are we going to meet today that's going to be screaming, yelling and threatening to punch it? Seriously.
Oh, wow. Yes. So, Rhonda, do you think, are you still going to use it next week, maybe with the theory that fewer people will get on when it's half price?
Yes, I think so. I'm hoping so.
Oh, Rhonda, that's some...
It's a good idea in theory, but there's not the infrastructure. You don't have enough carriages.
No, if you don't have enough carriages where people are fighting, you don't want that. Rhonda, thank you for calling in. John, you're in Wangaratta. What's been your experience?
Well, it's all very well if you live in the suburbs, but it's quite unfair if you live in a regional area. I'm 20 kilometres out of town. So I'm paying, my taxes are going to subsidise city folk. And I think that's grossly unfair because I'm getting no benefit from it, but my taxes aren't coming down.
And so it's just not there for you, John. You couldn't take advantage of it.
No, there's no way no one could take advantage of it. And I guess it's, again, people in the country are being overlooked. There's no votes in us, you see. There's votes in the city. And it's just really unfair that we're not getting any... benefit from this program. So I'm disappointed. I think it's been extremely wasteful program.
John, it certainly has exposed the inequity when it comes to transport across Australia between rural and urban areas. Thank you, John. That's a really important point. Joining us again is Malad Haghani, who's from the University of Melbourne, who's been breaking down the numbers, a survey that you held with people. I mean, what you found also, Malad, is that the people who do want to go back to public transport need it to be not just low price, but also reliable and accessible, yeah, absolutely. Obviously.
Absolutely. I think John and Liz both raised really important points. We know from this period of study who has been able to take advantage of the free public transport and who has missed out. So the biggest predictor of a person who has been able to use free public transport is a person with a mixed history of car and public transport use. People who have in the past used public transport. That means people who have access to it, don't have prejudices against using public transport, and they know their routes and how they get their trips through public transport.
And so
we also have people who... Yes, please go ahead.
I was just going to ask, so what do you think is going to happen next week?
Next week, I think the large portion of the public transport demand is going to shift back to the car. I'm not personally looking forward to it. I'm taking my Mikey out. I'm right now on holiday. I'm not in Victoria, but I did think about it that when I go back, I need to have my Mikey fully charged and pay it. But across the board, we have realized that there is an element of equity to it. We asked people about their deal breakers. They said travel time is too long, or either I couldn't access it, it's too far from me, or it's too crowded. These are the three biggest deal breakers for people, and that creates an element of inequity for people who cannot use this free service just because it is mainly not accessible to them. So if I have one big takeaway from this whole period of a study is that if reducing car dependency is the main objective here, we think that having reliable, reasonably priced public transport that is accessible, close enough to your doorstep, is going to be more impactful in terms of reducing car dependency compared to free public transport that is accessible to some but not inaccessible to others.
Malad, thank you so much for bringing us your latest results. Appreciate it.
You're most welcome. Thank you.
Malad Haghani, Associate Professor and Principal Fellow in Urban Risk and Resilience at the University of Melbourne. This on text, as a tram driver, the level of stress has increased tenfold with free fares. I'm all for free fares, but stress amongst the drivers is through the roof. Yes, that goes to a very disturbing call there from Rhonda about people fighting over seats. I haven't seen that. I'm glad that hasn't happened. People have been talking on text about John clearly missing the fact that all public transport across Victoria was from free. Someone else says V-Line trips were free. Interestingly, there's reporting out, though, now that the latest V-Line monthly punctuality performance data showed that nearly half of the services on the Swan Hill and Echuca lines have really dropped. We're going to be going into that a little later, as Malad was talking about. Does that mean it was about the state of the carriages when it's overcrowded and you can't sit down, and what does it do when they're late as well? Does it make you want to continue with that social experiment or not? And Mohammed in Altona says, I already use public transport but travelled more because of the free travel, however, at the expense of cycling and walking. It definitely needs to be cheaper for short journeys, though. Keep those calls coming. 1300 222 774 is the number to call on the Conversation Hour. I want to hear about your views on public transport, whether you'll remember your Mikey, but also I want to hear from you. Is an independent that's going to get your vote if they're in an independent party? This is an idea that's been floated. Coming up next, we'll be talking to someone who's been an advisor in a political party and who works on the Hill to talk us through the implications for the independents.
This is The Conversation Hour with Mary Guerin.
So you've heard this morning that the whispers that maybe the Teals and other independents potentially would be getting together to form a party. What does that mean? Is that just a complete negation of their unique selling proposition? What does it mean? And why would they do that? Joining me now is Sean Kelly, a political commentator and former senior political advisor to Kevin Rudd and Julia Gillard, and also the author of the quarterly essay at the moment of What Does Labor Stand For? Thanks for joining me, Sean.
Thanks for having me on again.
I was really struck by something that you wrote about the Teals a couple of months ago, and I thought of that when I saw this news this morning about an independence party, where you compared the Teals to Trump, and not because, I'm quoting you, they're anything like Trump in temperament or policy, but because their appeal to Australians depends on not being part of the system. So what are they doing?
Oh, look, absolutely. I got a lot of blowback for that article because people were yelling, they're nothing like Trump. And of course, that's entirely fair. But the sense in which they are is there is just enormous frustration with the system. We've seen the rise of One Nation off the back of that. But really, this has been happening for quite a few electoral cycles now, where you've seen a trend away from the major parties. And you're right to say, well, what is going on? Why are they doing this? Because I think a big part of the appeal of independence, and certainly a big part of the appeal of the Teals, was the sense that they were separate from the major parties, that they were completely unlike the major parties, that they had autonomy, and most particularly, I really think this is very interesting, that they were local, that they were very interested in the local community and embedded there. And this is absolutely the risk in banding together to form a political party, if that is ultimately what happens, that it risks drawing them away from that local basis. Because I've certainly heard people say that this is the future of politics, that politics is going to become more localized in various ways. So I think there is a danger there. But in a way, this is what happened structurally. A few years ago, the financial columnist, Matt Levine, had this kind of riff about cryptocurrencies. And he was saying, well, cryptocurrency started as this kind of rebel form of currency. But then over time, people realized, well, if this is going to be my money, I want it to behave like money. I want it to be safely stored. I want to be able to transfer it to somebody and know who I'm transferring it to, and they want to know who they're getting it from. And so you see things as they enter a system start to take on the characteristics of that system. And I think that's broadly what we're seeing here. You have independents come in, they think, well, we're going to be completely different. But then they look around and they think, these political parties have some advantages that we don't. They can caucus, they can exchange ideas, they can split up their workload to work more efficiently. And in fact, interestingly, I think, Mary, the Teals have been operating in some respects like that for a few years. In 2023, they started having meetings, apparently, every Monday in an apartment in Deakin. This was reported in the Fin Review at the time. And part of the purpose of that meeting was to say, well, you deal with these issues and I'll focus on this set of policies and you focus on those set of policies, so that they could operate in a more efficient way. And that's starting to sound a lot like the way a political party operates.
Well, exactly. Not as formal, though. I was also struck by something I heard this morning on RAF's morning show. Cos Samaras from Redbridge Polling was talking to him, saying that many of the people who tend to vote for independence are anti-One Nation, and because of the rise of One Nation, they might like to see something more stable and formal to withstand the threats from the party system. This is what he had to say.
They'll get the votes that they've secured. I don't think they'll lose any support, but we're going to have to wait and see. If a party of that nature was established, it will largely win electorates in the big cities, and it will take seats off Labor too. There's no question about that.
So that's Cos Samaras laying out what could be a change of many dominoes falling from that particular point of view. But what do you think, Sean, of that notion that he doesn't think they'll lose any support? Like you say, it's a unique selling proposition. Sure, they might be getting used to seeing political parties around them, but surely we would have seen independence parties then before now. Or what is it about these times?
I think that we are going to see democratic proliferation over the next 10, 20 years in Australia. I think we are going to see a lot of new parties start. And again, this comes back to what I was referring to at the start with this decline away from the major parties. As people stop turning to the major parties, something else has to spring up in their place. And originally, the big mover most recently was the Teals, probably the Greens a little bit before them. And then you have One Nation. And I think One Nation is very much acting as a proxy at the moment. They are a proxy for people's frustration. They are a way of saying, let's blow up the system, or at the very least, we don't trust the major parties anymore. But, you know, COS is exactly right. There are a lot of people whose politics don't align with One Nation. They're looking around for alternatives, and some of them have already gone to the Teals. So I don't see why you wouldn't have more of them. And this is the point that Malcolm Turnbull's been making this morning. He's been saying, well, the Liberal Party has moved to the right, and that has obviously left a gap in the centre of politics. And so the Teals are moving in there. And I, you know, in a very funny way, I think we're really talking about almost a replication of the old Liberal Party, you know, some socially moderate views, some economically conservative views. This is largely where the Teals were, with a party, you know, that would be a party, but where people would be reasonably free to follow their conscience, as was true of the old Liberal Party.
That would have to be part of it, wouldn't it? That they can't set themselves up as a party and say, now we're going to be a machine.
Exactly. And I think this is one of the problems with the contemporary Liberal Party, that it has become much more like a machine. And then as it has shed, you know, some moderate Liberals, it's become much more like a very narrow machine focused on one side of politics, increasingly the right side. But I think, you've also got a bit of a gap on the left. Of course, you have the Greens, but the Greens, I think, on some level are hampered by their heritage, the sense that they come from a particular environmental point of view. A large part of the electorate sees them as very strong activists. I think as the Labour Party moves into the centre of politics, which it's obviously expressed some desire to do in the last few years, that leaves a bit of a gap on the left. Now, perhaps the Greens find a way to fill that, or perhaps we see more of this democratic proliferation and another party finds a way to fill that space.
You're listening to Sean Kelly, political commentator for the Nine newspapers, former senior political advisor to a couple of prime ministers in the Labor Party. You've been talking there, Sean, about what this might mean for Labor and the whole political landscape. Just thinking this out, if it is in fact the structural elements that are disadvantaging the independents, even Monique Ryan, who ruled herself out this morning, said, we're still talking about the disadvantages within our system baked in for independents, such as donation law caps and so forth.
Right.
Does this provide some sort of motivation for the Prime Minister to change that? Basically, wouldn't he want independents to stay independent? It's out there as a theory, but.
No, I love it. That's a very good question. This often happens, doesn't it? Political parties try to do things that they think will protect their interests, and inevitably there are unintended consequences, and the effects end up being perverse. So absolutely, Labor Party and the coalition worked together to pass donations laws that have made sure there are clear caps in place for local electorates. Political parties have an advantage then because they have a higher cap for overall donations to a party or overall spending, and that party can also then funnel its money to the electorates that it most needs to fight in. And so there is now an advantage for political parties, and absolutely that could lead to this perverse consequence of the Labor and Liberal, of their new party springing up.
Yeah, you're living in interesting times there on the Hill, Sean. Thank you so much for your insights. That's Sean Kelly, who's political commentator for the Nine newspapers. And also you can catch his quarterly essay 100, What Does Labor Stand For? This on text, the independents have just realised they cannot achieve real progress as independents. Now their desperation is shining. That's from Sean. And this as well, the appeal of the Teals, Pocock, etc., is precisely that they are independent of parties and more immune to corporate donations and lobbying. What do you think? 1300 222 774. Does it make you more likely to vote for an independent or not as likely? This is the Conversation Hour. It's 26 minutes to 12. Tell me what you think of the independents, what you think also of free public transport ending this week. But also, we are spending almost $10 billion annually. us Australians on food for our pets. Are you cooking up some gourmet grub right now for Goofy? Now, I thought it was a dog. Someone on text has said actually it was a bovine. But you tell me, how much are you spending on your pets? We're going to be talking to the people behind the latest survey and dig into why it's so important that we understand how devoted we are to our pets.
This is The Conversation Hour with Mary Guerin.
We are going to be talking about pets in our lives. Are we treating them more like humans than animals? Look at all of the money that we spend. Is that all right? Tell me, what are you spending on your pets? What does it say about us? 1300 222 774. What's the biggest thing that you're splashing out on when it comes to pets? Also this hour, though, we have been talking about the latest news that teals, some teal, so-called teals, and potentially other independents are talking about forming a party. Does that make you more or less inclined to vote for them? Mike, you've called in from Fern Tree Gully. What did you want to say?
Thanks for taking my call. I think that the Labor Party has quietly moved into that space that the Libs previously, you know, occupied in the middle right, and things like the gas tax and, you know, Labor quietly supporting corporations and so forth is one of the reasons the Libs are being pushed out.
Mm. So you think this is going to come at the expense of the Liberal Party?
Yeah, and even both to a degree. So, like I said, I think it's been happening very quietly. It harks back to the Hawke era where the Labor Party, you know, moved further to the right. And it's that middle ground. That's where the votes are. So I think the Teals provided, you know, it's like with any party, provided you're not too extreme, I think they could, you know, obtain a lot of votes by if they do form a party. And I'm a big fan of David Pocock and what he says.
Yeah, he hasn't ruled it out. He hasn't said that he's going to join, but I think he was described as having one of the best political brands around at the moment. We heard this morning, Mike, from a couple of experts who, I think surprisingly to me, said that potentially the independents wouldn't lose votes if they did do that. What do you think? Would you be more or less inclined to vote for an independent in a party?
Look, I've always been a huge fan of independents, and I think the biggest problem with our political system is where these preferences go. So we don't really see it. I'm a big consumer of politics. Don't like politicians necessarily, but love politics and follow it. So, yeah, I think provided that party doesn't, you know, jar too many people with anything extreme, like I said, it's the middle ground, that's where the votes are. So all these independents have got their different views, but the fact that they're supporting the environment, they're supporting primarily the people, and that's what, you know, really resonates with me, David Pocock, is, you know, they're elected members, you know, they represent our electorate, and with the major parties, you don't really get that representation, I feel.
Yeah, you're going for the person, not the brand.
Yeah, and, you know, like these independents, they struggle to make a difference because it's the parties that hold all the sway, so that's where I'm always looking how I can, you know, maximise my vote. So,
exactly. If they are maximising their power, maybe you're maximising the vote. Mike, thank you so much. Really interesting points there. Alan, you're in Benalla. What do you think about it?
Well, I'm in Indi, and we had Cathy McGowan for 6 years. We've had Helen Haines for about a similar amount of time, about 6 years. So I've had,
and she's ruled herself out of this talk?
Well, there's still an independent, whether they go a party or independent. But I'd just like to say, I haven't seen like a Benalla, Euroa, Wangaratta hospitals. I'll give you an example from my own perspective. I had to get an x-ray, two actually recently. And if I got them at Benalla or Euroa or Shepparton, if I'd driven further away, would have cost me $294 for the x-ray. I drove to Melbourne, to the northern suburbs, this was last week, and it was bulk billed.
Right. So you don't – so is this a comment, do you think, on having an independent MP?
It is, because they don't –
I mean, hospitals are more state, obviously. Well, but you're talking about the Medicare system.
But our independent AT MP constantly spruces, you know, they're going to do more about hospitals, even at the Albury-Wodonga thing. You know, we're going to push for that. But pushing for it doesn't get you results. 12 years of an independent, and for me having to drive 200 kilometres to get x-rays, otherwise I'd pay $274,
you're getting bang for your political buck?
No, I don't at all.
Yeah.
It's not working for us, for me anyway.
Alan, I hope you're going well. And yeah, that the results are all very good for you as well. Thank you so much for joining the conversation. It's 21 minutes to 12. We will continue with that as well. I can see some texts coming in, and I can also see some texts supporting my view that Goofy is a dog. Someone else told me it was a cow. But that isn't what we're talking about. We're talking about how much we are spending on our pets. What is it saying about us? Are we starting to treat pets more like children than animals? 1300 222 774. How much do you splash out on your pet? Is it premium all the way? Tell me, is it that or is it kibble? This is cost of living talk. Ben Stapley is the CEO of the Animal Medicines Australia. And Animal Medicines Australia has been conducting pet census data on how much we're spending on our pets in general, including that eye-watering amount on pet food alone, $10 billion annually, and that's gone up 51% since 2022. Ben, thank you so much for calling me, for joining us today, for joining me. We called you.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
What do you think is going on with this rise in spending on our pets?
I think we're probably seeing a number of things. I mean, part of it is a bit of an inflation issue, but part of it is a real increase. I mean, overall, compared to 2022, Australians are spending $21.3 billion on their pets. But as you say, $9.8 billion of that is on food. What we also see is that people really are seeing pets more as part of the family rather than just an animal that we keep.
Mm. What are the biggest areas they're splashing out on?
So, as I mentioned, pet food is the number one expenditure at $9.8 billion. That's followed by veterinary services at $1.9 billion and products and accessories at $1.4
billion. Mm. You talked about premiumisation, which I'm not really sure is a word, but what are the sort of the stories that jump out at you or the amounts of money that jumped out at you in this data?
Well, I think some of the things that we do see are a lot of people spending money on things that traditionally we wouldn't necessarily expect in terms of the pet ownership experience. Mm. So we see things like businesses that are specifically catering to pets' needs. So we've seen businesses opening up around targeting pet bakery treats or daycare for pets, particularly dogs. So things which are really targeting a premium experience for pets and pet owners.
1300 222 774. Tell me, are you being a foodie lover on behalf of your pooch? What are you cooking up? Do you spend a lot of money on pet food, on making your own pet food? 1300 222 774 is the number to call. Yes, one of those things is about the gourmet food, fresh meal services for dogs as well. Really at odds with all of the cost of living talk that we have, you know, the pressures that people are under. What do you think is at play there?
Well, I think it really reflects the value of the bond between pets and their owners, and the fact that pet owners really value the relationship that they have with their animals and want to give them the best possible life.
But what about the people who are struggling as well? Is that also part of the picture?
Yeah, so our report found that approximately 1 in 8 pet owners sought financial assistance to be able to meet some of the costs of keeping their pet, particularly when it came to the health care of that animal.
Mm-hmm. Diane, you called in from Wodonga. What do you spend money on for your pet?
Yes, I spend a lot of money with vet bills. She gets a bit of tummy problems sometimes. I've got on a very special diet with a vet food, special tin food.
Is this a pup, Diane?
Sorry?
Is this a puppy?
No, she's a Papillon and she's 9 years old now.
Yeah, okay, but a pooch. How much would you spend on your pooch, Diane?
Oh, dear, I don't know. probably at least a few $1,000s with vet bills, that's for sure.
Do you have to give things up in your own life for that, Diane?
Well, yes, I have to be very careful with my own money, but I don't really give things up especially. But yes, I have to be careful. I don't go on holidays hardly at all. I can't afford holidays and things like that anymore.
Diane, that's really interesting. Thank you for calling. Kevin in Geelong, I think you've got a similar story as Diane. Is that right?
That's correct. The other thing that is way too expensive, of course, is the neutering, which we've all got to do because, you know, we don't want strays roaming around the countryside. But, yeah, Oscar was just put down in the last few weeks. But the other thing I will make the observation is I feel like the vet was keeping him alive a little bit longer than he needed to be. The conversation could have been had a lot earlier without the aid of drugs and everything else. Cost me a lot of money just to let him limp along, and I should have been ahead of this probably.
Oh, yeah, Kevin, it sounds like he's still really mourning Oscar. Yeah.
Well, he's. I took a little bit of time, but I've got a new kitten now, and he's a barrel of laughs. But
what's his name?
His name's Jerry. After the mouse.
Jerry, of course. Oh, Kevin, thank you so much for calling. And, yeah, valet Oscar, but good luck with Jerry. I'm sure, giving you lots of joy. Ben Stapley is CEO of Animal Medicines Australia, looking into how much we spend on our pets. And, Ben, those vet bills coming up again and again on text as well.
Yeah, and it is a real challenge. I mean, the cost of pet ownership is one of the constant challenges that has always pops up through our survey. I mean, I think the thing that really is a challenge for so many pet owners is there's no Medicare for pets, there's no PBS, so you're paying the full cost of the care of that animal. And that is often a really significant challenge for a lot of people. I think one of the things that you can take away is that there's a really important story around prevention. So one of the best things that you can do to mitigate some of those veterinary costs is keep on top of things like vaccination and parasiticide treatments and have a really strong relationship with your vet to be able to pick up on those issues early.
Indeed. It is 14 minutes to 12. We're talking about how much we spend on our pets. Elizabeth from Darley, you have 7 cats, is that right?
Yes, that's right. We had 6 until recently, and then I fostered a kitten, and she's too gorgeous not to keep.
Oh, of course. So how much would you be spending?
Well, the other day I dropped 100 at Bunnings on some food and litter, and my husband purchased a supplement for one of our older cats to help with his hip and, you know, joints and things like that. He also had an operation earlier in the year, which was about $1,000 to have something removed from his eye. And another one went the other day, and that was a couple of hundred because he had a little wound on his shoulder. So it's expensive, but we just love them so much.
Yeah, you don't count it. Yeah. Yeah,
exactly. They just are who they are. And like the guy said, have a great relationship with our vet. And, yeah, just kind of try and keep on top of all their issues.
That sounds absolutely delightful, and I can only imagine the scene at your house right now, Elizabeth.
It's gorgeous.
Yeah, I bet. Thank you. Ben Stapley, before I let you go, you were talking there about, you know, the costs and a lot of it not being covered. Animal Medicines Australia does some advocacy work. Are you going to try and get some breaks for people when it comes to that?
Yeah, look, I think that there are some really important potential programs to be able to support pet owners during some really tough decision making that they might need to make around the end of life of an animal or for expensive treatments. There's a couple of great programs which potentially are available to be able to reduce costs in some of those circumstances. So I'd encourage everybody to have a bit of a look around and see what might be available in their area.
Ben, thank you so much for sharing that data and guiding us through it.
No worries. Happy to be here.
Ben Stapley is CEO of Animal Medicines Australia. I will get to more of the calls and texts, really interesting texts and calls coming through on this. It is 12 minutes to 12, though, and next we're going to be talking about the closure of a sexual health facility in the CBD, even as sexually transmitted infections are at near record highs. So why is it closing and what's going on?
This is The Conversation Hour with Mary Guerin.
So it's emerged that Sexual Health Victoria is going to close its Melbourne CBD facility at the end of the month. But at the same time, the sexually transmitted infections are at near record highs. The government says that it is continuing to provide consistent funding to the service. So what is going on? Caroline Mulcahy is CEO of Sexual Health Victoria. Thanks for joining us this morning, Caroline.
Thank you. Welcome.
Tell me, why is the CBD facility closing when the government says it's provided consistent funding and continuing to do that to the service?
Well, first of all, let me tell you a little bit about Sexual Health Victoria. We're a health and education centre, and we do have two clinics, one in the CBD and a larger one up at Box Hill. And we've been serving the community for about 56 years at various sites over Victoria. Last year, we offered about 17,000 appointments. And so we're a large sexual and reproductive health provider. But unfortunately, our clinic in the city is probably, one, not being able to meet demand. As you say, sexually transmitted infections are on the rise. But the clinic is just not fit for purpose anymore. So we're limited in size there. It's just too small to meet demand, but also because of our business and operating costs have just continued to rise. We're just not able anymore to make it operationally viable.
So you're saying that when the state government says, look, we're continuing to contribute, you needed a boost in order to improve that facility. Is that what you're saying?
We do. We haven't had a funding review for possibly 15 years. And whilst we are getting consistent CPI increases, they're not meeting our operational costs, about 80% of which is professional staff. So we're run by doctors, nurses and teachers in the community. And so CPI just doesn't cover that. Indexation's about 2.6%. We know that our business costs, such as our insurance, our rental, our utilities, they're averaging an increase about 15% per year. So the government are right. They have had a super focus on women's health across Victoria. They've opened a number of women's health hubs. However, we haven't been part of that strategy because we're a Victorian statewide service for women, men and all gender diverse people. Mm. And so we're not actually getting any of that women's health funding.
Right. Carolyn McKay is from Sexual Health Victoria. We're talking about the closure of the CBD facility at the end of the month. Carolyn, it struck me that the STI rates are at near record highs. Can you just give us a bit of an idea as to why?
That's probably a good question. We're all sexual beings. And so we did see a major increase just after we came out of COVID. And I think that was because people started to go back to their normal living and seeing each other again. And you're quite right. The most common sexually transmitted infection at the moment is chlamydia, followed closely behind by syphilis and gonorrhea, and all of those have increased markedly in the last 5 years.
So what sort of impact is the closure of the CBD facility going to have?
Well, it means that there'll be one less sexually transmitted infection and sexual reproductive health clinic in the CBD, which again is accessed by people who come to work in the CBD and many students. There are other services available than CBD. The major impact will be that we won't be there anymore. We've been there a very long time. We're very well known by our clients and sector and stakeholders who refer to us as an accessible and affordable service.
And I think most people actually drop in, is that right?
No, we're actually more appointment based, but we have...
But in sense of that, they come in person?
They can do, yeah.
Mm.
And we're right on Elizabeth Street, so it's very accessible for people coming off, you know, Flinders Street trains, but also the university campuses.
So what would you have to say to people who might be affected by this? What's their first port of call? Is it to go to Box Hill, the Box Hill facility?
We would love you to ring our Box Hill facility. We've got appointments available. And in fact, the three rooms, consulting rooms that we had in the CBD, we now have an additional three consulting rooms at Box Hill. But of course, we also offer telehealth appointments.
And is there any chance that you'll be able to keep this open? Are you in talks with the government or the department, or is this it?
Unfortunately, we're moving out on Thursday, Friday this week, so I think this is it. We have been in talks with the Minister for Health, and we've also contacted the Premier's office. If there is any funding, or we can, you know, come to the table, talk about funding. I think our CBD clinic just isn't big enough for us. So we would love to have a funding discussion and maybe consider opening another 10-room clinic somewhere else within the CBD, maybe out on the fringes in the west, the north, or even somewhere across Victoria.
Carolyn, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Carolyn McKay is from Sexual Health Victoria. She's the CEO, and that's the CBD facility closing at the end of the month. Also this hour, we've been talking about how much we spend on our pets. Andrew, you've called in from Fitzroy North. What's been your experience?
We had a beautiful Whippet Cross, a rescue, for 10 years, and Lootsy Lou collapsed suddenly in the park, so we had to rush her to emergency. Her heart sac was filled with blood, and the vet said that she would not recover from this. They could drain the heart, but we'd get 24 hours. We paid $5,000. For that 24 hours because we couldn't get hold of my son, and it was his first dog.
Oh.
And we thought it was so important that he got to say goodbye to her. So we paid $5,000 and kept her alive. She actually lasted for another 3 weeks and then got suddenly again.
Loopsy Lou gave you value for money right to the very end, Andrea.
Value for money, and I would do it all again because... The you need to be able to say goodbye to them. You can't just lose them.
Oh, indeed. Condolences, Andrea, to you and your son as well. But yes, Loop-de-loo, obviously a great pooch there. Thank you so much for joining me, Mary Guerin, on The Conversation Hour. If you want to listen to any of this again, you can have us listen on the ABC Listen app. Just look for Conversation Hour on that. And write to me, conversationhour@abc.net.au. Tell me about the show. Tell me what we should be covering. I'd love to hear from you.